you're actually peacocking by saying, I am different.
Write that down, Doug. It's reverse peacocking.
Well, yeah, you're like a peacock that shaves all of the feathers.
Right, exactly. Instead of a bald peacock.
You're a peacock who's plucked all your feathers.
Hey, which works because you are bald.
Exactly. It's perfect. Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. Sure. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer. This is Sell or Die. I'm joined today by the absent and now present
Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute. It's great to be back, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Jenny. And we're going to be talking today to Vanessa Van Edwards, a woman who gives speeches about giving speeches.
But before we get into that, it's time to share a shout out. And this one is from Brent. Brent writes, it's been a long time since we last spoke, 2 years maybe. Just wanted to give you a shout out for the great work you and Jeffrey are doing. Loving the podcast, Sell or Die. Hope to meet up with you sometime down the road. All my best. Hey, Brent, thanks for the shout out. Guys, here's what we need you to do. Post this as a 5-star review. Well, not Brent's review, but post your review as a 5-star review on iTunes. Email us a screenshot, and we'll be sending you a very special gift.
That if you get the gift in the mail and you decide you want to do a little post on Facebook, we might even go further than that special little gift.
Oh, right. We're all about giving here on Sell or Die, giving information, giving knowledge, giving interesting facts that are going to help you make more sales.
Doug seems like he wants to talk.
Well, I just wanted to say that we love hearing feedback from our diehards on email, but it helps us tremendously if those same pieces of feedback go up on iTunes or the stars on Overcast or the reviews on Stitcher as well. Those really help us climb the rankings and help other diehards find us.
Exactly, and we kick butt of people like NPR. Come on. We are not the stock theatrical podcast. We're over the edge. We're on the edge. We're allowed to say bad words or even what they rhyme with. And we're having a good time here. And we want you to have a good time too. We want you to share it with both your friends and try to get them to listen and subscribe as well.
Mm-hmm. Because they'll benefit from it.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
You were gone, weren't you?
I was gone. I was on a writing retreat. I think a lot of our diehards know that. And I came back with most of my book.
Oh, you came book with your back?
Yeah, I came back with my back.
Very good. Hard to come book with that back.
Oh, man. No, I came back with most of my book written. So I'm super psyched about that. And thanks for holding down the fort while I was out, Jeffrey.
It was very difficult. Doug and I, we were sweating bullets, weren't we, Doug? We missed the hell out of her. We put your earphones up on the desk to pay sort of homage to your absence.
Oh, that's so
right.
Nice.
We lit some candles. We made a shrine. Yeah. It wasn't the same.
Doug was saying he didn't miss you worth a shit. Yeah, I don't know what the hell that meant.
I never said that. That was a bold lie.
Oh, no, wait. That was not a.
You can tell by the.
That's not a.
You can tell it was a lie by the micro expressions on my face.
Oh, yeah.
That is correct.
You know what?
That is a great segue, Doug.
Oh, my God.
We have an amazing guest coming up, and I can say that because I listened to your interview with Vanessa Van Edwards, the author of the book Cultivate, and she's incredible.
Oh, yeah. She's a smart woman. And she's a well-poised woman, and she is she's a student of the process, which I thought was exceptionally impressive. Her intelligence was phenomenal about how she read people and could, you know, create emotion.
And the one thing you're going to notice about that in this interview is it's not only that she has a great sort of intuitive feeling about how people act and behave, but this is a science. I mean, she has research that backs up a lot of this.
That's right. She's the lead investigator at the Science of People, a human behavior lab, and she designs original research experiments to crack the code of human behavior.
Oh my gosh. She's also a gesture human being. She talks about the importance of gesturing to get other people to listen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky.
Actually, she and from what I listened to, she talked about the fact that people who use gestures are way more well liked or well heard than people who don't use as many gestures.
There's an oxymoron there. I've been giving gestures to opposing Philadelphia teams since I was seven, and they don't seem to like
they that. They love your gestures,
that's a
Jeffrey.
Different kind of gesture.
So she's been featured on NPR, The Wall Street Journal, The Today Show, USA Today, and she's written for CNN, Fast Company, and Forbes.
I think we better get to this interview, Jen. This is a woman who still needs an introduction, but we're gonna go to the interview because she will introduce herself the best.
All right, let's
please
get into it.
Please help me welcome Vanessa Van Edwards.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Pleasure. It's important to intro people with a little bit of verve, you know what I mean?
I like the pizzazz there.
Well, I mean, your whole book called Captivate, I mean, that's what the whole deal is, right? I'm supposed to captivate the audience, and you're supposed to captivate the audience with a couple of questions that I'm going to throw at you.
I'm ready.
Because you are the self-proclaimed behavioral investigator queen.
Yes.
So what does that actually mean? What do you investigate, actually?
So really, the title is an excuse for me to ask invasively personal questions for my own amusement. I mean, really? I was like, what title can I give myself where I will have free license to ask people whatever I want? So basically what we really do is I get to design behavioral experiments. So usually we
I mean, like Pavlov's dog kind of thing, or does it go beyond that?
Yeah. I mean, anything that we like to start with an academic nugget. So there's all this amazing academic research out there. But the problem is usually it's buried in academic journals, right? It's a 20-page jargon-filled paper, and you read it and go, what can I get from this? Or more importantly, will this work in real life? So what we try to do is find studies with some kind of interesting nugget that I can test on a larger scale. So for example, one of the things we talk about in the book, which is the first impression study. So like about first impressions and, you know, how quickly do we make these thin slices of people? I thought, okay, this works in a classroom, but could it work in a business environment? So we think about, okay, could we test this at a networking event or online? So we devised a study where we looked at digital first impressions using people's Twitter profile pictures. Mm-hmm. To see if people could speed read popularity based on a Twitter profile picture. So we do all these experiments trying to broaden all the great work that academics are doing into the business world.
Are there little tips and tricks that you have about making that first impression? I mean, suppose somebody is a billionaire and they walk in with blue jeans or cutoff shorts and flip-flops.
Yeah. So here's the thing is I think that all first impressions are right if they match your nonverbal brand. So everyone has a different kind of nonverbal brand. Like I think that there are multiple flavors of charisma. You know, some people are going to want that booming kind of presidential personality of charisma. Mm-hmm. They should be in a suit, you know, a tailored, beautiful suit, really powerful walk. But some people, like a Steve Jobs, have a totally different brand of charisma, where he's going to walk out on stage in jeans and a turtleneck. Whereas some others still, you know, maybe it's a CEO of a surf company. If he walked out in a suit, his first impression would be a mismatch with his brand or his nonverbal brand. So I think we think a lot about branding in terms of a corporate sense, like our logos, our colors, but actually what we wear, how we carry ourselves, how we speak, all should match the nonverbal ideals of our brand. And that when people talk about authenticity, I think that's actually what they're talking about.
And Vanessa, in your book, Captivating, part one is all about mastering the first 5 minutes of any interaction, that first impression. Why is that first 5 minutes so important?
Yeah. So what's interesting is our brain is doing a lot in those first 5 minutes, even those first few seconds. It's trying to check off a number of things in a mental checklist. Now, we don't consciously do this, but subconsciously, when we first meet someone, the very first thing we want to know is, are we safe? Right? Like just from a very survival instinct.
That's not what New York people think. They think, is this guy a jackass?
I think that I actually would argue with you in New York. If you're on the subway in New York City and you see someone give you the fear micro expressions.
Yeah, but that's rare. Let's talk about a business environment, not a subway environment. Everyone's afraid in the subway. Hell, I'm afraid in the bagel place sometimes. But I think that when you're in a business meeting in New York City, is this guy a jackass? Is this guy full of himself? Is this guy, you know? Just think about the impression you're trying to give off in a big city in a networking meeting.
I wish that we could turn off that checklist of feeling safe, but we can't. So I like that you brought up this idea of, okay, this guy's just a jackass, because our brain, even though we know we're in a networking event, no one's going to attack me, our brain still has to check that off. And so here's what happens is the very first way that we know if we're safe is usually by looking at hands. And the reason for this is because our hands are our deadliest weapons. So for example, if someone's about to punch us, right, we see that coming, we look for fists. If someone's carrying a weapon, we look in their hands. So in caveman days, if we were approached by a stranger caveman, the very first place we looked was their hands, see if they were carrying a rock or a spear. That's why police say, get your hands up. So even though we know at a networking event or a business meeting that we are safe, our brain actually first looks at the hands before looking at the face.
So how do you bridge the gap from safe to asshole?
I mean, I don't know if there is one.
Oh, there has to be. Come on. There has
to be. So the first level is safe, right? And by the way, the way that you hack this is making sure that your hands are visible, especially in the first few seconds. So avoiding like having your hands full of things or having your hands in your pockets, because if you don't, the brain's amygdala where we process fear gets super active. Yeah, keep your hands up.
How about shaking hands?
That is why we instinctively, especially in Western cultures, like to shake hands, because it's the ultimate, you are not carrying anything, we are palm to palm. Also, the moment we shake hands, we produce a chemical called oxytocin, and that helps us get along with someone. So for example, let's say that you meet someone who's a total jerk, you don't like them at all. If you shake hands with them, your body produces the hormone that you need to at least try to build rapport with them. So the best way that you can try to get through the jerkiness or whatever, the barriers to entry, is to actually get the chemical in your body going that you can try to bond with them or connect with them. And it's a very chemical subconscious thing that's happening when we have that physical moment of touch.
How about jazz hands out of those?
Jazz hands. So it's funny because I used to teach hand gestures. So I used to teach have visible hands. It's really important to have hand gestures. However, there is a spectrum, right? So on the very bottom end of the spectrum, you have stiff, non-visible hands where someone feels like you can't trust them. They're hiding their hand. But on the upper end of the spectrum, just movement for the sake of movement is completely distracting. So they've actually found that women especially, but anyone who gestures outside the strike zone, you know, the baseball strike zone. Mm-hmm. So if I'm gesturing out here, you actually see me, or you know, beyond my strike zone, you see me as more disorganized, more chaotic.
Yeah, I mean, I see you as go away.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, ugh, it's too much. So there is a sweet spot. That sweet spot is purposeful explanatory gestures. And you know this, like if you watch TED Talks, so we did a huge study in our lab on TED Talks. We analyzed a couple thousand hours of TED Talks, took us a long time, and we counted the number of hand gestures based on view count. And we found that the most popular TED talkers, the ones who have the most views, use an average of 472 hand gestures in 18 minutes, whereas the least popular TED talkers use an average of 272.
Whoa.
And what's a huge difference? What's happening here?
I'd be popular.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think what's happening here is the really good speakers, the ones who just captivate you literally, they're kind of outlining their words for you as they speak. So if I say to you, I have a really big idea, and I hold my fingers in a really small way, you're like, wait, what? Your brain doesn't understand. I said big idea, but I'm showing something small. And so congruency with hand gestures is really important. So jazz hands, if I'm just doing this, there's no congruency with my words. But the best salesmen, the best pitches, they're able to be really congruent non-verbally and verbally. And I think that that's where our brain is like completely captivated in.
By the way, Vanessa, that was one of the most fantastic TED Talks that I've ever seen because it was so meta. It was great. You were doing a TED Talk about a TED Talk. It was fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I was doing a TED Talk about a TED Talk, but the pressure was on because I was talking about the best TED Talks and giving a TED Talk. Whew, I was like quaking in my boots. I was literally shaking in those heels.
How did you time it?
Climb the what? The nervousness?
How did you time the talk?
Time it. So what I do with my talks very specifically is I like to hit the brain with three different hooks every minute. So every minute, and this is for most of my talks, under an hour. I would say it's hard to do this over an hour. I try to have story, science, aha moment. So I create flashcards for every minute. So there's three flashcards per minute. So an 18-minute TED talk, 18 times three, a lot.
You got it. Yeah, 21.
That number. Right. That number. I don't do math. I'm pregnant. I don't do math. So I had three different color cards and I had those three per minute. And so I timed it based on that. So if I had a story, it had to fit with the other ones in that minute.
Cool. You could probably be more accurate in pregnant counting if you counted pickles.
Yeah, but I do like pickles, but I've always liked pickles. So I don't think that's a fair judge for pregnant.
So you want to say something?
I was just going to ask, you mentioned the word micro expression a little while ago. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So a micro expression is a very brief, involuntary facial expression that we all feel and we all use with an intense emotion. So these are actually, it used to be believed that you looked at a baby's face or a baby looked at their mother's face and it was mirrored or learned facial expressions. But actually, Dr. Paul Ekman found that facial expressions are innate. So they're not a learned behavior. This means that there are expressions that are universal. So for example, fear is one that I talked about earlier. So fear is when you can try this with me if you want. You can raise your eyebrows up as far as they'll go, widen your eyes so the whites show, and then take in a breath. Mm-hmm. That face keeps us safe because our eyes widen to take in as much as possible. Our eyebrows lift up, our mouth opens to take in oxygen. And so our facial expressions have evolved to keep us safe as well as social cues. So they have found 7 universal micro expressions. And if you know how to spot these 7 universal micro expressions, it's incredibly helpful for spotting hidden emotions.
Do you know them?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, so they're sadness, surprise, fear, anger, happiness, contempt, disgust.
Oh, and I was waiting for like sleepy and grumpy, but cool. That's totally cool.
Grumpy is probably a mix of disgust and sadness.
Yeah, no, that's exceptionally insightful. I'd have to study it to see if there's one in the middle there somewhere that's missing. But are you saying that these 7 things are manifest in some facial expression one way or the other?
Yeah. So basically what they found is there's this, it's called the facial feedback hypothesis. So there's a loop. So not only do your emotions cause your face, but your face also causes your emotions. So for example, let's take sadness. So sadness is a really, really hard micro expression to fake. It's the hardest. It took me hours in the mirror to get it right. So basically what you have to do, you can try this with me, is you want to pinch the inner corners of your eyebrows together. So 2 like lines appear, and then you want to put your mouth into a frown, and then you want to pout your lower lids. It looks like that.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard to fake it. It's the expression people make before they cry. That's usually what they do. So with that face, when I feel sad, I make that face without even realizing it, and I cannot control it. I also, if I make that face right now, just I just did, I begin to feel sad. In fact, I might even be able to trigger my own tears. So a lot of actors will take our body language seminars, our business body language seminars, because they're trying to train themselves to trigger the emotion. This is also the basis of empathy. So if I'm with a friend and she's telling me a very sad story about something that's going on with her, she will make sadness. I will mirror that sadness and then literally feel as she feels.
Do you say something like, oh, that's horrible?
Yeah. I say, oh my God, that's so upsetting. I'm so sorry. Yeah. If I'm with a colleague, this is how I think you really want to talk about advanced pitching and client sales. If you can mirror and match and recognize facial expressions, people really feel heard. Right? Like it's like not like reading your mind.
Well, something at you. Let me interrupt you for just a second. When someone tells you a story, and the story has some emotion, requires some empathy. What normally happens is not the mirror part. I think the mirror part oftentimes is faked by the salesperson. Mm-hmm. What normally happens is you think of your story and you tell your story on top of their story. It's called a topper. It actually has a name. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you get something that really strikes you, it makes you think of your story and you tell, let me tell you about my automobile accident. Let me tell you about my job promotion. Let me tell you about the time I was fired. Kind of thing.
I think you are 100% right. And that what's happening there is actually kind of what we're talking about. So a topper, if someone shares a story that's really sad and you think, oh my God, I had my own kind
my
of
my dad died. Right.
Right. What's happening is your body is actually mirroring for you. In other words, the other person is telling a sad story. They're making a sadness microexpression. You begin without realizing it. I can make a sadness microexpression very faintly without you even realizing it. That triggers that feeling on my own body. And then all of a sudden, a memory comes to me. Mm-hmm. Because I made that same face 5 years ago when that happened to me. So what we're talking about here is a depth of emotional response that is body related. So emotions or stories are not just in our head, like, oh, you know, you had a sad story, I had the same thing. It's actually, you had a sad story and it made you feel that way. I can see that on your face. That triggers sadness in me. And then it reminds me of the exact last time I had that emotion. Got you. So it's this very, very interesting loop that if you're really connecting with someone, you're constantly having what I call a me too moment. So you're like, oh yeah, I had that too. Yes, me too. I felt that way too. And that's when you have really, that's the definition of rapport, I think.
So having that constant back and forth. I'm not in favor of that kind of response, but that's okay. Go back a little bit because we don't have history at all. Mm-hmm. Did you start in sales somewhere when you were 9 years old, 42 years old, 21 years old? When did you start in sales?
So I was always selling even as a kid. You know, I mean, I loved selling lemonade stands and I did a lot of car washing when I was younger. So yes, casually, of course. And then I accidentally got into sales a little bit when I was in college. I had to get a job to help pay for bills. And the only job that was hiring at the time that would take me was working at a telemarketing kind of setup. So we had to call.
Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had.
She sold HBO over the phone.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So this was the greatest thing that could have ever happened to me at the time, because I'm a recovering awkward person. So I'm very ambiverted, not always extrovert.
Yeah, I like that word. We studied you a little bit and I actually liked it. You can be awkward with either part of your body.
It takes me a lot to like be able to get over it. And so you have a second to have someone not hang up on you, and then you have to convince them to give you money. I mean, it is a hard, hard sell. So it forced me to get over it very quickly. So I would say that was a casual introduction to my first kind of sales, and it was the best thing I could have done.
Just a story for just 1 second. When Rebecca had just given birth to Morgan, my daughter, just giving birth to my granddaughter, she needed a job, and she went to this HBO place and was setting records for sales. And the guy, her boss, was wondering what the hell was this all about, and did a Google search on her and then me and called me up on the phone and go, I just want you to know your daughter's following in your footsteps. It was pretty cool.
God, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, I think, so yes, you can be born with it, but I also think it's learned. The question is did she learn that from you or did she inherit that from you?
She inherited it. I mean, it was learned and inherited. We grew up in a house of sales.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that I did not have it naturally. I had to really hone it and learn it.
Where did you go to college?
Emory University in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Great school.
And how much studying did you do of sales?
None. So that was the crazy thing is when I was at Emory, I was on a totally different track. I thought I was going to go into the Secret Service. So I was studying languages. I was taking Mandarin, studying international politics. And then when I started doing someone actually said to me, if you continue down this trail, you will never be able to have a family and you'll be traveling on the road all the time. And I thought to myself, I don't want to do that. So I was like, well, can I take these same skills and use them in the business world? And so that's sort of what got me on the path of trying to see if I could talk about decoding people, reading people, understanding behavior from a business perspective as opposed to a terrorist perspective.
That's cool. So is Mandarin with the snow peas or is Mandarin with the General Po's chicken?
What?
What do you mean? About Chinese food.
My Mandarin is really rusty, so don't ask me to try it because it will be rough.
One thing that I wanted to talk about, Anna, but I didn't want to interrupt you. When I go to a networking meeting, mm-hmm. I create disruption, and I do it very subtly. I don't wear a badge.
Interesting.
Everybody has a badge except me. I will never put a badge on till the day when I die, they'll put a badge on me. Although I'll probably be be buried in my work shirt. But
why?
Because people will either they know me.
Yeah.
Because I have a presence, or they don't know me and they'll come up and say, who are you?
Yeah. Do people ever assume that you work the event?
Pardon?
Do people ever assume that you work the event, like your AV or waiter or something like that?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
All the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't wear, especially when I'm wearing my maintenance shirt and I'm talking to 1,000 people, and I'll ask the audience, how many of you didn't know who I was, thought I was some kind of maintenance guy, and a third of the audience will raise their hand because they prejudge you.
So what's interesting about that is, have you heard of the phrase peacocking?
Sure. I think I have. Yeah. You spread your feathers and you try to act like a big shit.
So it's the idea that like you create like ornaments or cues to get people to come over to you. So yeah. For example, I have a lot of students who are in the pickup artist community, which is a totally different community than ours, but they say that they'll wear like crazy things when they go out so that people will say, "Hey, look at that boa. Hey, look at that crazy hat." What you're doing is actually peacocking in a different way by taking away a prop. So everyone is wearing a prop, but by taking away a prop, you're actually peacocking by saying, "I am different."
Write that down, Doug. It's a reverse peacocking.
Well, yeah, you're like a peacock that shaves all of the feathers.
Right, exactly. Instead of a bald peacock.
You're a peacock who's plucked all your feathers.
Hey, which works because you are bald.
Exactly. It's perfect.
I just feel like we've gotten to a depth of your soul that we've understood something very deep.
Well, I was taught early on by the great Nito Cobain, who is the speaker's speaker, currently the dean or the head of the school at High Point University. He never wore a name badge. He said, "Jeffrey, if you have to wear a name badge, it's because people don't know who you are."
Ah, so can I tell you about my other theory about name badges now that we're talking about badges?
Please do.
So it's interesting that you use, I actually like this. You're taking a badge away because it's a way of saying you either know me or you don't.
Right.
It's a way of siphoning the crowd to get the brave people. Because if someone doesn't know you, but they're curious why you don't know a badge, they're going to be brave enough to come up to you and say, "Hey, who are you?" So it's a very clever way to get your fans or get people who are brave and then get new fans. So I love it. I like to use badges as a way to combat my awkwardness. So one of my greatest fears as a recovering awkward person is silences. So weird pauses or silences. And second, running out of things to say and then rambling or saying nothing. So I use badges as a way to calm my own anxiety with awkwardness. So for example, I will often try to, one, add a conversation starter to the bottom of my badge. So I will take out the badge out of a little plastic sleeve and I will write below my name something that's going to help the other person ask me about something or talk about something. So it could be like my favorite quote. I could literally write "guilty pleasure : and fill in the blank with whatever I think it is that day. Mm-hmm. Then I will often also bring something for the back of the badge. So if my badge accidentally flips over and my name isn't showing, I will usually put something back there, either a card or a quote or a joke.
See other
so
side.
People see it. Yes. Yeah. So like badges for me are almost like a comfort stone or what are those? Like a security blanket.
Yeah.
My badge is my security blanket. So it's so funny that we approach badges in a very different way.
Yeah. Actually, we had a boot camp and we had big badges and I made people put where they grew up, their favorite book, where they went to college, their favorite movie, so that it automatically started the conversation. I don't have to say, "What's your favorite book?" I can just look and it said Atlas Shrugged.
Yes.
What's your favorite book?
Favorite book would be Why Men Don't Listen and Why Women Can't Read Maps.
Oh.
Who wrote that?
That's Barbara and Alan Pease. I actually found that book on my mom's bedside table, took it from her. It was the first self-help book I ever read. And it totally, I think probably is the reason why I do what I do now, that one book.
Wow.
How old were you at the time?
Oh my goodness. I must have been like 13 or 14.
Cool.
Probably.
That's amazing how that can make an impact.
It was the first time I had ever heard people explained in a systematic way. So I was people would always be like, "Make friends." You know, my parents would send me to camp, like shove me on the school bus and be like, "Just be yourself." And I'd be like, "But I don't like myself." Like it was like a horrible, like, you know, I was like one of those really like neurotic, shy kids. Mm-hmm. And so it was the first time a book had formulas for conversation, had formulas for people. And I was like, how has no one told me this? I remember that very specifically. And I was like, I will read every book like this. And I took that book to Borders, was a day, you know, in that time, Borders was around.
Dated.
And I was like, give me every book that you have like this. And I kind of looked at me weirdly because it was a little bit of a marriage book and I was like very young. But that's how I discovered, influence. That's how I discovered How to Win Friends and Influence People because of that one.
Can you give us the name of the book again?
Sure. It's Why Men Don't Listen and Why Women Can't Read Maps. And it's still a great book even today.
And we will put that in our show notes.
It's really good for understanding the opposite sex and both like partners, dads.
Is the author still alive?
Yeah, Barbara and Alan Pease are awesome. They do. They wrote the definitive book of body
language.
I
know who they are.
Yeah, yeah. So it was. I think it might have been one of their first books together, actually.
Cool.
I'm interested in that concept of someone telling you to be yourself and you basically responding how, because you hear that all the time, right? Be true to thine own self. But then what's the next step? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah. So it's like, here are the phrases that absolutely drive me just bat poop crazy. Be yourself.
Have a good
day. Pick your brain is another one. I don't like that. Yeah. One either. Yeah. Pick your brain. Just do what you're passionate about. Like what? That doesn't make sense. Be authentic. Like those are the phrases that just, they drive me crazy because I don't really know what they mean. And I think that they're challenging something. It's like saying nothing. It's like saying fluff, in my opinion.
People call me all the time and say, can I pick your brain and buy you lunch? And I said, well, I have $1,000 an hour fee to pick my brain and I'll buy you lunch.
So I have a filter set up in my Gmail that if anyone puts pick your brain in an email, it goes right to my spam. I do. I really do.
That's a classic.
Because I know that like pick your brain. It, you know what it is. So we're not talking to VIPs, but I think it's a skill to be able to.
Malcolm Gladwell is not going to call you up and say, hey, can I pick your brain?
Right, exactly. And pick your brain puts the onus on the other person to do the work. And that's a problem because if you are going in and everyone has a specific question or agenda, if you say, I want to pick your brain, you're basically telling the other person, I want you to entertain me and teach me over lunch.
Right. And by the way, I'm going to give you nothing.
Yeah. Worse than that, I'm going to ask for a favor. That's actually what's going to happen at the lunch. Yeah. After you entertain me for 30 minutes.
Yeah. Will you be my mentor?
Yeah, exactly. That's another really good one. I should put a filter for that.
Yeah.
Will you be my mentor?
But so look, you have talent and you have skill, but more important, I think you have information, and that information can be used by others to help them succeed. Who's this? Who's your publisher?
Penguin Random House.
And who's your guy?
Oh, my editor?
Yeah.
Nikki Papadopoulos is my editor. Okay. She's wonderful.
Do you know Adrian Zakheim?
Oh, yes, Adrian. So I have a really good story about Adrian. When we were promoting the book, he's going to love this. We were promoting the book. I wanted to do really unique ways to promote. So what we decided to do is take the cover, which is my face, cut out my face and do posters where people could put their own captivated face in the book cover. And so people were taking social media pictures of their captivated face. And Adrian was the very first person to do it. So I have a picture of him making his captivated face with it, with a cutout of my long hair and everything.
He's an interesting character. I'll just say that.
He's so funny. He humored me. He humored me with this book because it's definitely a unique one. And he was like, I'm going to go with it. I'm going to go with your uniqueness, Vanessa. I'll let you captivate.
Cool. He bought the sales Bible when I first was selling my book in Manhattan. From William Morrow, a now defunct company.
And do you like publishing? Are you going to continue publishing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my next book will come out by Amazon.
Yeah.
They are publishing. All other publishers pale by comparison.
Oh, I've self-published 3 and traditionally published 2, and it is a beast of work. I don't know
if I have... Don't self-publish anything. You make no money. let me explain something. Every morning, Random House goes in a room and talks about what Amazon.com did yesterday. And every morning, Amazon goes in their room and they don't give a shit what Random House did yesterday.
That's the most accurate thing I've heard in a while.
Boom.
Boom. Mic drop. That was good.
Well, the last guy that dropped the mic lost the election.
Don't tell Adrian.
So Vanessa, The Science of People is a human behavior lab. Tell us, what do you have cooking up in the lab?
Whoa,
right now?
What experiments are you doing?
Yes. So right now we're working on a really cool vocal power experiment. So one of the things I kept seeing in our keyword research, so we do, you know, reverse keyword research to see what people are searching to get to our website, was a lot of how to sound confident on the phone, how to like the sound of your own voice, vocal power, those kinds of things. And I was like, what an interesting topic. And vocal power is an aspect of nonverbal behavior, right? Nonverbal is body language, facial expressions, voice tone, and ornaments. And we didn't have a lot of vocal power. So what we're doing right now is we're doing this huge experiment. We recorded the same person with different hellos in different facial expressions and body language. So for example, you answer the phone, hello. we are doing it with different facial expressions. So if I actually sound different when I answer the hello. So here's my happy hello. Hello. Here's my sad hello. Hello. So you can actually, it actually changes the shape of my vocal cords. And we
Vanessa, are there more than happy and sad? Can we try to, you do a hello and let's try to guess what hello means?
Yeah, there's way more. Okay, so here's one. I'll let you guess what micro expression it is. Hold on 1 second. Hello?
A little pissed off.
Confused.
No, a little pissed off.
Ooh, pissed off. Anger. Yeah, that one's anger micro expression.
How about
Wait, you're cheating, Jeffrey, because
I'm
you
looking
can
at
see her.
Yeah,
I can't see her.
All right,
that's
go ahead.
Cheating.
Go again, Doug.
Okay, everyone has to close their eyes then.
Okay, yeah, yeah, close, my, yeah, close
I'll
your
close
eyes.
I'll close my eyes,
Jeffrey.
I swear to God.
Don't cheat.
You close
go
your
ahead,
eyes.
Go okay. ahead.
You ready?
Yeah.
Hello?
You're busy.
You already did sad. Afraid.
No,
afraid.
Busy.
You're right. Fear. Fear
yes.
micro expression.
All right. 1-1. Do you have one more? Because this is going to break the tie. 1-1.
I do. I have one.
Not
more
that we're in competition to one another, but I want to kick his ass.
Okay. This is a hard one. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Hello?
Surprised.
No. Wow. I'm curious about who's calling. I'm a little afraid of who's going to be calling me.
So it's disgust, which is also a facet of like embarrassed. So disgust is when you crinkle your nose.
You don't
up
need to, you don't need to use that anymore. You can see who's calling you. If the guy's an asshole, you just let it go to voicemail.
Yeah, or you have to answer it, and you're like, "Hello."
Yeah.
So what we're testing is one. Do they sound different? That was an easy hypothesis. The answer was yes. The second thing we're testing is likability. So we're having people listen to the hellos without knowing, obviously not seeing anything, and rate the person on likability. So I like this person a lot. I don't like this person, or I like this person a little. And we're trying to see if we can hear the negative micro expressions versus the positive ones, and if that changes our perceptions of who they are. Because your first impression happens with hello. That's
yeah.
it. That's all you
well,
got.
I try to answer my phone the same every time, so no one would know whether I'm pissed off or not. But let me ask you this question. Do you own the company?
Yes.
Okay, so it's all yours?
Yes.
Good. Okay, good. So you're not the lead investigator. You're the chief investor, the CEO, and if the toilet's broken, you got to go fix it.
Well, actually, we just brought my husband on as CEO, so I guess.
Cool. Yeah. So he fixes the toilets.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's CEO, I believe, investigator, and then we have an amazing team of researchers.
Cool. I was going to say, honey, you should own the company. I mean, you're so damn good and very, very astute about what's happening in the world. Maybe sometimes too astute, but I would challenge you that you're on the right path. You have definitely have a clear understanding of people.
I think that we have a lot to go in how we're understanding people and how we can use that in business. So where I think we're going is like, what's the science and how do we use it?
So,
look,
you guys,
show me your Captivate face.
Huh?
Here, remove the book and then show. Ah, that's a good. You look a little astounded.
Well, the Phillies just hit a home run.
Astounded.
Okay, so the book is very worthwhile. I would challenge you not only to buy the book, read the book, study the book, but go to the videos that are posted online and watch them because they're insightful, especially the TED Talk about the TED Talk. I think that everyone should watch that. How many million views do you have?
On YouTube, I think we're at 11 million.
Whoa, that's pretty cool, isn't it?
I mean,
if you had a nickel,
you mean a penny, you mean a half of a cent of a half of a half of a half.
No,
if you a had penny, yes.
Fuck pennies. You want a nickel?
I would love to have a nickel.
So it's been a pleasure. We certainly wish you a happy, healthy baby.
Thank you.
We are going to invite you back on. You can have your baby in your lap if you would like. We'll have you back in a few months to talk about some other things about the captivation factor. I'm yes, sure you're going to continue to do new research about people, and maybe we'll do height or weight or, you know, how do you have a pre-prejudice about somebody when just looking at them before they say one word?
Oh, so many. And you know, science of parenting might be coming next too. So we'll see about that.
Yeah. Well, if you need advice, buzz me. I have a lot like your little squirt. Yeah, I'm the man of 1,000 diapers.
Oh, hopefully that will be my husband soon too.
Yeah, well, we'll see. They're trainable. But I'm going to tell you, it's a struggle in the very beginning, but it's so worthwhile.
Well, hopefully I'll survive and then I can come back and share all the stories.
Well, we'll go to Cannon Beach and hang out.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
It's a pleasure. We'll take care of you. Hey, Captivate, you guys. This is the book, Vanessa Van Edwards. Worth it, worth every cent of it, and we'll teach you what to do and how to do it. Well, I have to say, Doug, that was one of our best interviews in terms of thought provocation.
Yeah, she offered a lot of insight into how we basically use our bodies and our voices in ways that sometimes we're controlling and sometimes we may not be controlling.
Exactly. And, you know, I pushed back on her when we were talking about mirroring because I think mirroring is one of the worst things you can do as a salesperson.
You're anti-mirroring.
I'm totally, especially when, well, if the guy's talking fast, you talk fast. Well, suppose the guy's wearing a dress. You're going to wear a dress? So there's, you have to reach a point of mirroring. But what she was talking about was way more insightful. She was talking about automatic, not, you know, involuntary mirroring. And I was talking about contrived mirroring. So there's definitely a difference there. And I would go with her philosophy that says you might mirror automatically without knowing it.
And is the difference there, so I mirror you because I'm listening to you, I'm being empathetic, I'm feeling your emotions versus I'm sort of playing the mime game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was insightful, deeply insightful, because she was talking about things that we as people rarely think about. And she's made a science of it. She's made a science study of it. And the thing I really liked was that she's the lead investigator. No, she's the CEO. She's the founder and downplays it.
Well, and the other cool thing, and we've talked to a lot of people like this on this show, she really saw an opportunity and a niche to carve and carved it and dominates it right
jumped
now.
Jumped on it. Yeah, totally jumped on it. And I think that her career is just beginning.
And I love what she said about the TED Talk too, that she took a huge risk by going to a TED Talk and talking about the great TED Talks. Now you have to be great because you've now set yourself up to do that. And she was, but that's a big risk to take.
Well, I found the interview to be intellectually stimulating. My questions were so easily conveyed because they were right on the tip of my tongue. She actually created curiosity. I didn't have to think about my curiosity. It was right there.
Yeah, she was using some of those behavioral hacks on us.
Yeah. We were, you know what? Damn her.
No, she was amazing.
All right, so everybody, if you're listening, you want to go to Captivate on Amazon and just click the buy now button. If you're a one-click buyer like we are. Is everyone here a one-click buyer? Alex, you're a one-click buyer? Yeah.
I have to be careful now, Jeffrey, because I have a business account and a regular account. So I have to I can't really buy with one click anymore. I gotta like keep it separate.
Oh, come on.
I know.
I just click.
I should just have created a different account.
Yeah, exactly. But for those of you out there who only have one account, and you have a buy now account with one click. You want to just one click it and buy it and it'll get there in a couple of days.
And make sure to go to scienceofpeople.com. You can actually watch the TED Talk there that we mentioned in the show and check out their other material as well.
We talked a little bit about Amazon domination. I have to tell you, my book called Truthful Living is going to be coming out on it with Amazon before the end of the year, before the end of 2018. I just had a meeting with their public relations people today. I've been doing this for 25 years. I have never had a more in-depth meeting about how to brand a book, promote a book, and sell a book than I did in that hour and a half with Amazon and their PR people. Unbelievable. Absolutely floored me with what they're about to do.
How did it differ from your first few meetings with traditional publishers way back when?
Most of the time, they went and hired an outside company. I don't think it's fair for me to say who it is, but they hired an outside company. Most of the publishers do it in-house, number one. Number two, they have interns doing the publishing that are doing the publicity, and they're not very current. They're hardworking, but they're not insightful yet. These people gave me a 5-page document before I even started about what they were going to do and how they were going to promote, and challenged me to the edge of my gray matter about what am I going to do and how are we going to collaborate. So we're going to have someone from a big publication is going to come down to Charlotte and sit in the library with me. And we're going to talk about the book.
So they floored you with being prepared,
yep.
with being committed,
yep.
and with having information that you haven't been able to find anywhere else.
And they were excited about it. I mean, I could feel the energy on the phone with both Amazon and their PR people. I was just stoked. It was amazing.
Jeffrey, that reminds me of when I bought my first house, and then I loved the experience with the realtor, so we decided to go with him to sell the house.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought us a binder with not only, hey, I'm going to sell your house, he said, here's how I'm going to sell your house,
oh, cool.
and how I'm going to get you the price. And he floored us with how prepared he was, how committed he was, and the amount of information that he had that we had not heard anywhere else.
That's totally cool. And you know, the real estate people who make all the money make it in listing, not in buying, not in selling.
Mm.
There's double the money in listing. Just one of those kind of things that you might want to pass on if you're in real estate and you're just selling a house, you might want to be a lister. This is sell or die for those of you who are just joining. It's I'm without Jen today because she's on her writing retreat. She will be back in the next episode to talk to you about what that retreat was and how she brought the dog and how the dog helped her and playing tennis and how that helped her. But for the moment, I'll have a Charlotte seminar. This is going to air afterwards.
Yeah, we'll cut out all that because it's June 19th.
But go to the Gittimer Learning Academy and check it out at GittimerLearningAcademy.com. You'll find all kinds of things that you can learn about how to not just win at sales, but win at life. And my name is Jeffrey Gittimer. I am the author of The Little Red Book of Selling and a bunch of other books. And I'm joined today by the great Doug Branson, who is demure, but pretty darn with it. And I am very appreciative of our partnership and our ability to put this podcast on because he's actually the brains behind the screen. And I'll see you guys next week. I'm reminding you, if you have never heard this before, get out there and sell something. Even if your ass falls off. Sell or diehards, attention. If you love the show, make sure you have subscribed to the show.
And if you've subscribed, make sure you rate us on iTunes and give us a star on Overcast.
And if you've done all of that, tell a friend, tell both your friends about the best sales podcast on the planet.
And if you've done all of that, well, you're a true seller diehard, and we thank you.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup.